knew what he was doing. That framing for 185 looks good. I mean, he knows exactly how to deliver a good, solid 185. And yet, all my life I've been watching the boxier, taller version, and I don't see any extraneous or clearly unnecessary images or portions of images in that film. It seems to me that the entire 133 or 137 image of On the Waterfront, frame by frame, is really well taken care of. And it's really quite a beautifully shot film, I think.
Well, that's a tribute, of course, to him protecting. I mean, yeah. That's a filmmaker who knows all aspects of things.
Right.
It is a fact, and this is documented as far as polls, exhibitor polls that were taken across the country, that even by December of 1953,
right,
almost 60% of theaters in the country had already converted to widescreen.
Right.
And a large part of it wasn't necessarily because of flat widescreen. It was because most of these theaters were gearing up to run CinemaScope anyway. So they were installing these widescreens for the CinemaScope format, but of course, you know, you want to get the most. It's like people today, I think, foolishly stretching out 133 images on a 16:9 frame. You want to get the most real estate of your screen. So, of course, most of these places that installed widescreen, not just for flat widescreen, but for CinemaScope, we're going to be running the films in flat widescreen anyway. But a lot of theaters, even small neighborhood theaters, were installing widescreens before September of 1953, when the Rover premiered. I can tell you, for example, my own theater, which was around in 1953,
right,
it was part of a smaller chain of theaters. We installed a widescreen in June of 1953.
Well, I imagine that this investment in the coming thing was prompted by great, profound concern about the encroachment of television and the diminishment of the motion picture audience.
There's a larger picture than that. It's not just television. It was the fact that the parent companies that owned a lot of the major theater chains in the country had been split from the studios, of course,
yeah,
and that caused a huge financial rift with them. But the reason that you see this happen in 1952, 1953, is because in 1948, there was a freeze put on television stations by the FCC. There were only actually 108 operating television stations in the United States during that time, and they wouldn't give out extra FCC permits for broadcasting until they figured out 5 points of problems that they were having thus far. The freeze was lifted in, I believe, April of 1952, and that is when you start seeing this 3D and widescreen revolution happen in 1953, because that you really see the impact of TV at that point. A lot of people start buying television sets who were previously in areas where there weren't even television stations broadcasting. In some states, there were zero stations, believe it or not, up until that point. With theaters, the installations were supposed to pay for themselves, and in a large part, they did. It was up to the exhibitors to pay for this. It really wasn't something that the exhibitors wanted to do. You know, who wants to spend that kind of money something in unless it's going to attract people? The studios were the one that came up with this idea. In fact, flat widescreen, the way it's done by composing within a 137 frame, goes back to the early 30s. Universal was proposing this idea as early as 1930, when the first wave of widescreen films came in processes like Grandeur and
are you talking about the Raoul Walsh John Wayne film, what was that film called, the big widescreen one that they had?
The Big Trail.
What year is that? That's amazing. I've seen that once. That's really quite a film. You know, that's. But you're not saying that. Go ahead.
There's another one called The Bat Whispers, and that's an old dark house mystery, which was shot both with this grandeur process and with a typical 133 photography, and the widescreen just blows the standard out of the water.
Right. Well, I still don't. understand, and I don't. And I just love what they're doing at Criterion. I love what Masters of Cinemas does, and I know that it's more expensive, of course, to issue both versions. But I can't understand.
I also think it's ironic that although Francis Ford Coppola was outspoken about 185, that aside from One for the Heart, which was a complete flop when it came out, and all his films were shot either 185 or scope.
No, no, he's a realist. He understands. Oh, by the way, speaking of something really curious, this is odd, but I swear to God, this dates me. But I remember seeing The Godfather at a tender age in Boston in 70. What year was that out? 71.
71, yeah.
And I swear to God, this is. It doesn't make any sense, but I swear to God, I knew enough about what I was seeing as a big time cineast, even at that period in my life. They showed it at 137.
Mm-hmm.
In a big theater. It wasn't some.
Well, first, no. I think that would have been a wrong presentation.
No, no, I understand. It was intended.
I know you know that. I know you know that.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying that would have been a wrong presentation simply because not only is the film composed for 185, I believe the film's pretty extensively hard matted. Why a theater would run something like that in the 70s, do you remember the theater that you saw it at?
Yeah, it was on, it was definitely a major theater in the combat zone right off Tremont Street.
Mm-hmm.
And I was saying to myself, this is so cool. What they're doing is that they're presenting a film set in the mid-40s to roughly 1950. And they're making it look like it was actually shown back then. They're giving it that older look by showing it in the older aspect ratio of the 40s. And
right.
I thought that was a really cool thing. And then I saw it later again, and of course it's not that way. And yet, as we know, it's been shown on television in many formats, the Godfather trilogy and the sequential thing. And it was protected for that aspect ratio. You can see,
I will add to this, though, A, it was not, because it's hard matted, and B, that if a filmmaker wanted to, they could do a 137 presentation, and in fact, that was done in the 50s and 60s by actually pillar boxing the image in 185 frame or pillar boxing an image in a scope frame.
Wait a minute, can I just stop for a second? You're saying that The Godfather was hard matted, therefore television presentations of that film with 137 or 133, the shape of the old TV screen.
They would be pan and scan. They would be pan and scan.
Really? So we were losing the sides. We were not seeing a full frame because there was no such thing as a 133 or 137 full frame. Okay.
Correct.
Okay.
That was the case with any film that was hard matted, which is why hard matting really took off in the late 50s. It was there's a lot of technical reasons why you would hard mat a film, but essentially they started doing this around 1957. And I'm discounting things like VistaVision, where they essentially had to hard mat the film on the frame because the original film itself was locked into a certain shape. But they started doing hard matting in the late 50s,
mm-hmm.
and it was actually recommended after films started getting sold to television in the late 50s that they cut that back. And so there's a legitimate argument that, you might have a film that's protected for 137.
Uh-huh.
Because of television sales, but in the 1950s, I don't think that was a realistic expectation. In fact, when RKO sold their library, the industry just came down on them. It was not a good thing. The industry was really against it, and it wasn't until Columbia Pictures sold their Screen Gems package in 1957 that they finally conceded. And ironically enough, I think there's no coincidence that when they sold that package to television, you start seeing hard matting coming in.
Okay. Well, I was a projectionist, as I said, in Connecticut in 79 and 80 to 81. I remember distinctly. I was a rep house, so yes, mostly older films. But I remember distinctly films that were, you know, I'm holding the film in my hand. I didn't see exclusive hard matting back then. Obviously, many were. But I didn't see that as an exclusive practice.
It wasn't an exclusive practice, but it was a common practice. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't necessarily in every shot. You know, it depended on camera to camera because, yeah, for the most part, hard matting is done in the camera.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's done in an optical printer, too, mm-hmm, and that's got its own reasoning. But for the most part, the films have shots that go in and out. I know there's a lot of hubbub over Stanley Kubrick and his intentions.
Yeah, well, his... But 185 was well established in the industry by the time Dr. Strangelove came out in late 63, and yet he shot his film, and I still prefer to watch the boxier version that came out in the DVD in the early aughts rather than the present,
yeah,
you know.
Oh, you're talking about the 137 presentation?
Yeah.
The second unit footage in that film has hard mats in it.
Well, fine.
And I know there's a sort of explanation that I think is really rather a cavalier and ignorant attitude about the sort of variable aspect ratio thing within the film. But, you know, nobody does a variable aspect ratio with one hard mat on the top of the frame, you know. Uh-huh. If you're going to do something that's widescreen, you're obviously going to balance it out with something on the top and the bottom.
Yeah.
I think it's true that Kubrick had expectations that films would be shown on television.
Yeah.
Although, of course, I think he was horrified when 2001 was presented on television and was pan and scan.
Oh, that must have been awful for him, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
But I think, first and foremost, as a filmmaker, he knew that the most people that were going to see this film, mm-hmm, and the way the film was going to make money and build a reputation, right, was to be seen in the theaters, and the theatrical impact was the most important.
All I know is that something in my spirit, in my soul, alights and is made happy. I feel whole and spherical when I see a film like Dr. Strangelove in the boxier version, because I see elements of the image that seem totally proper and balanced, and they don't look extraneous. And again, I just keep coming back, why would someone say, listen, I don't want to see any more images than what the strict constructionists of the 185 theology wanted to see. In other words, cut all that stuff out. In fact, cut it out for the rest of the time that that human beings live on this planet. Get rid of that height, that breathing space, that extra image, because it shouldn't be seen. Because why? Because exhibitors and distributors wanted to present an enhanced viewing experience to people.
Well, I think filmmakers did too.
I don't agree
with Coppola's assessment that 185 was just an exhibitor or a studio thing.
A scam.
And in fact,
yeah,
I've got, mm-hmm, interviews with a number of even rather obscure filmmakers,
mm-hmm,
from the early 50s in which they say, yeah, you know, I liked the old way, but I admire the new way too. I remember there was one filmmaker in particular who had made a film in Israel, and he,
yeah,
said, and I shot it with 1.66, and I liked the challenge because,
yeah,
previously I could do things that were very height oriented,
mm-hmm,
but now I could go at it and shoot these films in a way where I had to be creative about composing my shots for this new format.
I swear to God that I saw Rosemary's Baby in Paris once. And it was a long time ago. We're talking my first backpacking trip over to Paris in 76. And I remember vividly, and I know that they have different standards over there, and I saw it in a 1.66 format. I know I did. And
And
I was
most
told
theaters in Europe were set up for that format, but it doesn't mean that was correct.
Yeah, but there was image there. There was a slightly more height there, and I have.
Of course, there's more image on the film. I mean, that's the reason why it it's not just television that they protected that stuff. I mean, not every screen is going to be perfectly 1.85 or even perfectly 1.66. You're going to have to spill off.
Yeah.
So, of course, they're going to protect the image above and below it, even to 1.37.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, for the most part, you weren't going to find theaters. I know you weren't going to find theaters. I've been around old-time projectionists long enough and spoken to almost all of them about the subject that it was pretty unanimous in this country that screens went widescreen. And usually somewhere in the range of 1.75 to 1.85 to even 2:1, which in my opinion was a wrong practice unless the films were composed for that ratio. But the fact remains is a lot of drive-ins, for example, did something where they would present scope films with the sides cut off at 2:1, and then they'd run flat films with the tops and bottoms cut off at 2:1.
Yeah, that simplifies things. Well,
you know, just one ratio straight across the board. Forget about what you're getting.
Yeah. Well, anyway, the general thing is, why chop stuff off? We don't have to listen to anybody anymore. We run the show now. This is 2012. I am alive and well. You are alive and well. Who gives a damn what they wanted back then? Even the directors. I don't see why we have to respect what they wanted. If we find a certain way of seeing, if images were captured in such a way so that it's pleasing and balanced and well thought out to the eye to see a taller, boxier version of a film, what is the problem in looking at it that way? I mean, sure, put out a 1.85 if you want to be a strict constructionist about it. That's okay. I know that put out a 1.78:1 version so that it perfectly fits our 16:9 screens. But why do we have to respect to anything? I mean, absolutely. I mean, why can't there be an option? What's wrong with seeing more images?
That question, why respect history at all? I mean, why let's whitewash everything?
Not whitewash it. Just say it was shot. The boxier, taller images were shot. They look good to my eyes. Why do we have to shut that part of that aspect of film history off and get rid of it? Which is what the industry is doing, because they all want these images for the most part to fit 16:9 screens, because that's what's going on. Believe me, as you know. If there was no such thing, for some stupid reason, if there was no such thing as a 16:9 high-def screen, and screens were still at the aspect ratio of the old television, you know damn well there wouldn't be this move to widen and show the pure 1.85 versions.
Perhaps not. It depends. I think with the advent of Laserdisc, that a lot of people were getting educated on widescreen. I think it would have gone in that direction anyway. I think widescreen TV sets were inevitable, and also I think the exact thing that you're talking about, this obsession with filling the screen, is exactly the single reason that these studios presented these flat films in the wrong ratio for the longest time, is because there were a lot of people out there who would never accept the idea that there were black spaces on their television set and that they were somehow being cheated out of something. And I think that's the case here. I think with a lot of the people who believe that these presentations should be 1.37, they feel they're being cheated out of something, but they're really not. They don't understand that was the intention, was to cut off the top and the bottom of the pictures. I mean, some films are still shot today, open mat. Should we run those films that way? Of course not. The directors are still alive and well. The producers and the directors of photography are still alive and well. And they would find it, an insult to have the work that they put into it, that was hard work, compromised by an improper presentation.
I think it's a whole different... I'm talking about strictly an era when there was a transitional mentality in the exhibitors, filmmakers, and distributors.
But by all accounts, it wasn't so slow. By all accounts, it was extremely fast. It was overnight. And as somebody else once pointed out to me quite aptly, the studios have to put money into making this happen. They have to make sure that the matte boxes are correct, the ground glass markings on the camera are correct, that foliage is laid out in a way that will be correct at 185. Lighting changes. You have to train your camera operators. You have to train your projectionists. You have to train your laboratories. This was not something that you could just turn around and say, I don't want to do it that way anymore.
Mm-hmm. Well,
once you put the money into it, you were stuck doing it.
Anybody shooting a film today, it could be regarded as a curio, as an odd experiment, like when Gus Van Sant shot Elephant and shot Last Days in a 1.33 or 1.37 format. That was strictly Gus just being himself and wanting to indulge
himself.
Yeah,
it's a curio.
Yeah.
It's a curio.
But that's, most people shoot fully understanding, and it's an extraneous and unnecessary thing to say, let's see if we can find taller, boxier aspect ratios for a film shot. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that anybody making a film for wide distribution in the 50s, I don't care what anybody says, myself, you, anybody, I know that they were thinking that this will eventually, that there are people out there that are not going to respect the new thing right away. There's certainly the television option, which is down the road. It didn't actually really become embraced by the industry until, the late 50s. But Million-Dollar Movie was showing movies. Everybody knew
that was a weird exception to the rule. And like I said, when that happened, the industry came down on RKO and General Tire so hard that you literally saw every opening section of every trade magazine discussing what a disgusting move that was and how RKO were traitors for doing this.
But it lasted until what? That show didn't go off in the air until what? The early 70s, was it? It lasted about 15 years, right?
Well, of course, but that's, like I said, that's an exception to the rule. Mm-hmm. And it took still yet another 2 years before Columbia finally caved and sold their package, and of course Universal sold their stuff through Sony, Columbia.
Yeah.
Through Columbia, and the floodgates opened. But there was a great resistance for showing any studio product on television. Look at in the early 50s, movies that were available for television. There were all this crap that was made by Monogram and PRC and Chesterfield and just the bottom of the barrel as far as that stuff was concerned.
Okay.
RKO was a company that was on the verge of bankruptcy in the first place. Howard Hughes had driven it into the ground.
Mm-hmm.
General Tire had taken it over, and they were going to get their money's worth out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So of course they were not film people.
Yeah.
They were not people of the industry. These were businessmen. These were the exact type people that I think you would find, you would have found it disgusting from the artist.
It's funny though.
People that they wanted to see the bottom line. They wanted to see the dollar sign.
These people were people that were not really people of the faith. They weren't movie Catholics. They were strictly businessmen. And yet, it's funny, the irony is that anybody who grew up in the tri-state area who got that, who was able to see that show, and it was only local, every cineast that I've spoken to who was around when that thing was going on, they all talk about the huge influence of being able to see the old films like Top Hat and King Kong and everything on Million-Dollar Movie twice a day for 7 days a week. That was a big formative thing, So I think,
and that goes to show what a big impact it had. Mm-hmm. I agree that it had a big impact, but I think up until that point,
mm-hmm.
and again, we're talking about something that happened 2 years after the events that we're talking about happened.
Yeah,
that it was a solemn oath among studios that they would not sell their films to television. Television to them was nothing more than an advertising tool for their films.
Yes.
Of course, they made tele-op cards that you could run on television.
Right.
They bought Time Out on local TV stations mm-hmm. to promote their films.
Right.
But the thought of actually putting something on television went against their entire business model. Mm-hmm. The whole idea was that when you went to the theater, and I mean, this is something that I think you would agree with, the cinematic experience is always the best experience.
Certainly.
Because you have an audience that you could laugh with for a comedy or cry with for a drama. It's on a big screen. You can see the actor's faces clearly. The sound is good. I think we've moved into an era now where, unfortunately, those things aren't prided anymore, and you've got home theater setups that are better than your average multiplex. And I think that's kind of sad, because I think movies have always been a social device, always been the social aspect of traditional theater going, where you go to something and you want to be moved with a crowd of other people.
Right. Okay, well, just to go back to, we'll have to wrap this up, but I know you have to do something at 9, but just to wrap it up, I'm going to ask you to indulge in an exercise. You are a Criterion executive. You are no longer who you are. You are now a Criterion executive. And I am asking you at a press conference and telling you how delighted I am their decision to present On the Waterfront in Blu-ray in 3 different aspect ratios. Can you please explain to us, Mr. Criterion Executive, why you decided to not just present the film the way most theaters in the country saw it, which is in 1.85? Why did you decide to give us 2 other aspect ratios?
Well, we gave you the theatrical aspect ratio, but in order to please some of our customers that we think would be displeased by the 1.85 ratio, right, and to make sure that we get their dollars for those units of DVDs, right, we made 3 different formats to make everybody happy so that I could get the maximum amount of sales possible.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that makes sense. But why did you, one would think that perhaps you might have followed, we're still continuing this fantasy here, you would follow what Masters of Cinema did with the Orson Welles film and present 2 different versions, the 1.85 version and the 1.33 or 1.37 version. Why did you also, and this is what really blew my mind, why 1.66 also? Why did you include that also?
I'm going to break this fantasy here. I honestly have no idea why they did that.
Okay.
But my guess is it had to do with Grover Crist's recommendation, which I totally respect.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, I look very much forward to that. Thank you very, very much for taking the time.
And don't forget, we've got the Capitol Fest in August. That's 9th, 10th, and 11th.
Yes.
At the Capitol Theater in Rome, New York. You can check it all out on our website. It's Rome Capitol, and that's capital with an O, not an A, .com.
Right. Festivals like yours at cherished old theaters, I think, really are the lifeblood of cinema culture. And I love that you're doing that particular festival. And I love, Glenn Kenny took me to another one in a little bit north of New York a couple of years ago. I just love that this stuff is happening. It's so vital for the vitality. It's important for the vitality and the, if you will, the religiosity of film love to have these kind of festivals.
Sure.
I think it's great that you're doing it.
Well, we appreciate that you appreciate it, because if it weren't for people who are cinephiles, we wouldn't be doing it.
Yeah. All right, man. I will also include a link to your festival when I put the recording up. And thanks again for engaging in this spirited debate about the way to properly absorb cinema of the 50s and 60s.
Well, thank you for your cordiality.
Okay, man. Have a good day.
Take care.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.